your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Rest make the heaven the middle. We are. Rest make the heaven the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We have just a really fine guest with us this evening, Dr. Guadalupe Carrera Cabrera, and she's the author of Los Zetas. And my gosh, this book is really a fine book. Los Zetas, Inc., Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. And she's an associate professor up at George Mason in Virginia. Welcome to our program, Guadalupe.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here, George. Thanks for your invitation.
Well, you know, this book, I heard just for our listening audience, we just had the Texas Book Festival this last weekend, and you were on a panel discussion. And like I was saying before, you have such enthusiasm for this subject. And what motivated you, Guadalupe, to write this book? What started you in the direction of working on such a large project as this?
Okay, I'm glad that you're talking about my enthusiasm. But more than that, it is a sense of need to communicate a phenomenon that I have and that I was able to live personally and in the course of the years when I live at the Mexico U.S. border teaching at the University of Texas at Brownsville. I have had personally, I'm from Mexico. I was born and raised in Mexico, and I have seen my country go in a direction that I never expected, not in the most positive sense, but violence in Mexico has transformed itself, and organized crime has transformed itself to the extent and at some point we didn't feel safe in many places in the country. And before when things were different, people could, you know, have their businesses and participate in, you know, in the economy in a different way. My parents, my father and my brother were personally, attacked, had an encounter with this new group of organized crime that was operating in Mexico, and that had a different logic, a different economic logic, and a different criminal model of operation. And they started to extract rents to different businesses and participate in different illegal markets. My father was asked to pay an extortion fee to the Zetas in the state of Michoacán. The Zetas arrived to the state of Michoacán and also communicated or expanded their model and expanded the model. And there was another organization that took this model and started to act in the state with the same methodologies, La Familia Michoacana. But in Michoacán, the Zetas asked my father for an extortion fee, and my father was not willing to do that, and so he received another threat, and he lost his business and his capability of continuing doing his job in his state of birth, which is the state of Michoacán. And at that time, I couldn't make sense of it, and I didn't understand what was happening in different parts of Mexico. Violence elevated to levels that we never imagined. And I went to leave in the year, that happened in the year 2006, and in the year 2009, I started working at the University of Texas at Brownsville, in the city of Brownsville, Texas, just on the other side, just at the Mexican border. And I was living 10 minutes from the city of Matamoros, Tamaulipas, that had been the cradle of the Gulf Cartel, the city of birth of one of the, at that time, one of the most successful drug trafficking organizations. That started to become important in the 20th century, in the decade of the 1980s. That so-called drug cartel was born in the city of Matamoros, and that cartel gave birth to the organization that I based my book on, which is Los Zetas. Los Zetas started as an arm wing of the Gulf Cartel, and they were members of the special forces of the Mexican army with access to high-caliber weapons and specialized training and, you know, participating in the border in different operations. And they happened to meet the person who was in charge of, Cercaena Ville, who was in charge of the Gulf Cartel, and they started to provide protection to this organization. And my argument in the book is that the Zetas changed the configuration of organized crime in Mexico, but not only in Mexico, but in the rest of the Americas, by militarizing the criminal world. Of course, you know, what happened in Colombia and the more involvement of military tactics in the business and the responses, the military responses to anti-trafficking operations had already taken place. But the Zetas incorporated a different logic of committing criminal activities not only in Mexico but in the Western Hemisphere. And I'm talking about the diversification of criminal activities that made this business not only being about drugs, but also being, you know, this diversification of criminal activities, the oligopolization of all criminal activities that happen in certain cities. It started in Tamaulipas, the state that I started studying and analyzing because I was teaching classes in Brownsville. Some of my students were crossing the border every day to take classes in the U.S. side, and they started to share with me their experiences, how their parents, as my own father, as my own brother, had to pay extortion fees, how some of them were kidnapped, how some of them were murdered, how many people were murdered, and situations that I never imagined. People hung in the main plaza of one of the city's policemen, local policemen in, for example, the city of Vallehermoso. Then we heard that the candidate to become the front runner in the gubernatorial competition, a gubernatorial election for the state of Tamaulipas, was murdered by the Zetas, allegedly. And also the discovery of 72 migrants that were killed because they refused to participate with the Zetas in August of 2010. In the year 2012, in the month of April, there was a discovery that several buses were kidnapped and nearly 200 bodies were buried in the city of San Fernando, also related to the practices of the Zetas, and a new whole logic of militarization of criminal groups took place exactly at the time when I was living, just very near, very close to this land of war, when the Gulf Cartel, and the Zetas separated, and they declared a sort of war among each other. This violence started to become unmanageable, and I happened to be there. I happened to listen to the shootings when one of the drug lords of the Gulf Cartel was chased by the Mexican federal forces, shootings the whole day, and the visual images of the other side of the border when they closed international bridges, some things that were unprecedented, and I had never lived in my whole life. And when I was crossing the border and feeling unsafe, and my students feeling unsafe and telling me all these stories when they were shooting and they had experienced all that, that was kind of a situation of war. I mean, the description of the whole situation and the involvement of the Mexican federal forces as a response to this new militarized criminal model was also, you know, turning the situation completely different. And this is what motivated me to write the book. And I am explaining it in a very lengthy way. But I wanted to say that this has to do with a personal experience that me, as many others, have lived. Many families have had to pay an extortion fee to different groups of organized crime that follow this new model. This new model does not have to do with drugs, but that has to do with this new way this new model of extracting rents or getting control of territories to commit different types of illegal activities. Stealing hydrocarbons, stealing fuel, coal, or getting involved in the music piracy business, or getting involved, or asking for extortion fee to different illegal businesses in certain cities, and this new logic of criminality that is present because of these capacity and the fact that these groups have access to specialized arms that are just for the usage of the army and specialized training also in the military. So this is what motivated me to write the book: personal experience, the experience of my students, and what I had that I was perceiving. Also, the fact that the media was not able to cover what was happening on the other side of the border in the state of Tamaulipas. The media was completely silenced at some point, and only the social media users that didn't want to become journalists, but acted as journalists in a way to defend or to protect, protect themselves and their families from this violence, trying to make them avoid certain places where violence was happening. So we talked through the social media, we talked to Twitter. I learned how to connect to this community of professionals, this community of people that were working, you know, as in different professions, in different jobs, or people that were not even working, women that were taking care of their children, but were very worried about their families and in a situation that really resembles a real war or a civil war, as I say in my book. My book is titled Losetas Incorporated, Criminal Corporations, Energy, and Civil War in Mexico. So I explain how this new model of organized crime that can be explained by utilizing business administration literature, or how can be understood as a corporation. How this model that was advanced with military tactics and the response of the government by utilizing the military and federal forces in public safety areas where they didn't belong, how this generated these levels of violence that can resemble to a civil war, or modern civil war, as I call it, a war that does not have to do with an ideological or political component, but that has as its main component an economic goal, and how that in the end benefits other interests, and particularly those that have to do with the energy sector, with the sector of hydrocarbons and the generation of energy.
Right. You know, you make a note in there about the energy policies of Mexico, the energy reform, I think you say. And have they opened it up to foreign interests now for bidding on some of these oil areas and so forth? What has been the reform that's occurred in Mexico energy?
Well, during that time, and it was very interesting because energy reform was passed in the year 2014. And 2014, the secondary legislation, or the enabling legislation that had to do with the passage of energy reform, a historical passage of legislation that we never thought it was going to happen so fast. after a period of war, after, like, all the logics were focused on combating organized crime, President Felipe Calderón, in the previous years, from 2006 to 2012, had declared a war on drugs that had, at the same time, caused so much destruction, and the attention was totally concentrated in the kingpins that were captured by the government, and also like this violence that was extreme in Mexico, and that the response of the government that even caused more extreme violence and all that. So that also affected the possibility of certain groups to oppose the reform. I mean, indirectly. I am not alleging that this was a particular motivation to do that, because I cannot prove that. But at the same time, this happened. Energy reform was passed. There were no other, I mean, opponents that were able to, were able to reject that or oppose to that. No social mobilization, as it had been in the past, and energy reform was passed. At the time that we saw, at the same time, violence and extreme levels of violence were not taking place in the regular parts that just are necessarily transportation routes for drugs. So routes for drugs were not necessarily what were driving these conflicts. These conflicts were about the control of territory. And this territory and these massacres and the violent response to these groups coincided, and I'm saying coincided, with regions that are rich in natural resources, mainly resources that have to do with the generation of energy, hydrocarbons and other natural resources such as iron ore, for example, that is used to produce iron and steel. In the end, or water, I mean, lands that are important in with regards to water, like the region of Allende, Coahuila, and the region that has some water and is rich in natural gas, shale gas, because it has, I mean, it's the same geological formation as the Eagle Ford Shale, and the Cuenca de Burgos, for example, all the region of the Gulf Coast, the state of Veracruz, for example, that it's an oil, oil-rich state, and I mean, some other parts in Chihuahua, in the Valley of Juarez, and I document in the book all these. All these territories that happen to coincide with these extreme levels of violence and this phenomenon that I call new civil wars, because of the level of violence that took place at that point.
So you're saying that Los Zetas has not only been drug dealing and transporting drugs, but they're getting into energy and coal and other businesses that they never even thought about doing before. Is that right?
Well, what they started doing, they started to provide protection to a specific drug trafficking organization, right, which was the Gulf Cartel. So they started to work for the Gulf Cartel as their guardians, as their arm wing, right?
Okay.
Because there was an important plaza, which is called Nuevo Laredo, which happens to be the most important international bridge that where the greatest amount of automobiles cross every day. In the two directions, right? It's called like the customs capital of Latin America, because of the number of automobiles that cross through there, and all the merchandise that cross through there, through the city of Laredo, through the Laredo Nuevo Laredo crossing point, the international bridges, and because of that was a key place where you know, substantial amount of drugs are allegedly, you know,
crossover,
mobilized.
A good crossover, like a port of entry. for drugs.
Exactly, like a port of entry for drugs. It's precisely because, you know, only 3 or 4% or even less than that is verified by the customs authorities in the United States, because there's no capacity to check that. So that's a port of entry for drugs. That's right. So because of that, because of trying to protect that territory that was contested by other groups, particularly the Sinaloa cartel, the story is that they had, I mean, that Ociel Cárdenas, who was like the head of that organization at that time, hired this group formed by members of the of former special forces of the Mexican army and involved them into their activities. And they started growing with the organization. They started to become independent. They started to work under the logic of extortion of rents. They provided protection to this group, but with a different logic, transform organized crime, and started to dedicate themselves to other activities in order also to get cash. And they were there, they were armed, they were protecting this drug trafficking plaza, but at the same time they started to make their own businesses. And I'm not saying that they were not transporting drugs. They wanted to continue doing that business, but controlling that, not only providing protection to the Gulf cartel, and that initiated the war between these two groups. This competition that now the Zetas became independent. The leader of the Gulf cartel was extradited to the United States. They continued working with them, but they wanted to have control of the main drug trafficking plazas
The Gulf cartel. I noticed Los Zetas has their own communication network too. Is that right?
Yes, they have their own communication network. There have been some.
So what they've been able to do is stay outside of the authorities from intercepting their communications, I guess. Do they do any encryption of that communications net within that network, or do you know?
Yes, they did. There have been some reports about their communication network, the very sophisticated communication network that they generated, that they created with help of people that were highly trained and that were working for them, either wanting or not wanting. But definitely there were some investigations that were conducted, and they found their network of communications was found and was identified clearly through an investigation of the Department of Justice. We don't know how intricate or how complex was this network, because the Zetas at some point were able to control an important part of the Mexican territory that occupied not one half, but an important part of one half of Mexico's territory. And the involvement in criminal activities in different parts of the country, like Guerrero or like Michoacán. This logic has changed.
Yeah. Los Zetas, they dominate within 17 of the 32 Mexican states. Is that a fair statement to say? Or are they have operations within 17 of the 32 Mexican states? Is that right?
At some point they had not control over the whole state.
Right.
They had control over some important territories of some of the states of Mexico, not all the states of Mexico, no, the 32 Mexican states, but they had control over an important portion of the territory, particularly the one that has to do with the northeastern part of Mexico and the Gulf Coast. But the regions where they control And it's that's the interesting part, our rich natural resources. And other groups that follow the same pattern have also had the control of these regions that happen to be, coincide with regions that are rich in some natural resources. For example, in the case of Guerrero, like groups of organized crime, Los Rojos, Los Guerreros Unidos, they also had their operations in places, for example, near a mine called Los Tilos, that it's one of the biggest mines of that has the gold reservoirs in the country, and probably also in the continent, right? But there would be an exaggeration to say that they dominated it all in the whole structures of different states. They dominated an important part of the criminal activities in these states.
Now the Marines seem to be very, very good at going in and busting up some of these operations. Is it the Mexican Marine group that does a lot of the anti-drug busting and things like that?
Are you talking about how Mexican law enforcement has
there's an army unit called Marines, I think it is.
And they seem to be
pretty important in disrupting and arresting some of the drug cartel members and so forth. Is that a special unit within the Mexican army?
Well, the Mexican Army had its operations. There was, like, of course, the Mexican Navy, the special operations of the Mexican Navy. They they captured important drug lords, but these captures were not performed only by one special unit of the Mexican government. You know, different drug lords were captured in different spaces and also with the collaboration of the United States under the Merida Initiative. Also, it's not that there was a special unit that went after all the drug lords, but definitely they were trained, they were trusted more, they had a closer cooperation with United States forces, with the United States law enforcement agencies, and they cooperated under, you know, better terms, the Mexican Marines, with the United States law enforcement agencies. But definitely that was a mandate by the presidential mandate the declaration of a so-called war on drugs, which is basically, you know, militarizing the operations against criminal organizations and also involving the federal police in local public safety activities.
Right. There's so much money involved in this that then a lot of officials or police can be easily corrupted. Does that exist in some of the states more so than others?
The model of the CETAS is based on corruption.
Right.
And the corruption of local law enforcement agents was part of the logic of operation. And they started like that in the state of Tamaulipas. They did the same thing in the state of Michoacán and Guerrero. So they started control the territory by involving also and corrupting and making them part of their model in these states. So definitely the CETAS, you know, transform the criminal activities in Mexico and change the face of organized crime in the country and further. The way that they did it was to incorporate, you know, the protection that they were selling at some point, that they sell to commit extortion, this protection has to do with their capacity of controlling local law enforcement agents and the police.
Okay.
Right. That is the logic that they use.
Now, let me ask you this. The militias in certain areas in Mexico have sprung up, but the Mexican government is not that enthusiastic about the militias. Are they not allowing the militias to flourish or to exist in some areas? And have the militias done some good in certain villages and cities in Mexico?
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Okay, the militias, these are individuals, mm-hmm. farming militias, mm-hmm. that are formed together to go against the drug cartel people to take back their villages and cities. and communities. Is that that's not very well supported by the government, Mexican government, is it?
I mean, these militias that you're talking about are like the criminal armies that they form, or these paramilitary groups.
These are honest militia men that have come together to protect their families and to protect their communities from the drug cartel, period.
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, and I have written about that, and there's a whole chapter in the book about that.
Right.
And this new paramilitarism in Mexico. Yes, there are self-defense groups that have appeared in different parts of the country. However, it's much more complicated than just calling them, you know, militias or self-defense groups that are defending themselves and their families from these bad people.
I understand
that notion of the good and the bad.
Yeah,
the government. Two things. We have the three different models of paramilitarization in Mexico.
Okay.
These self-defense groups, or allegedly self-defense groups, have in some cases become criminal.
I understand.
Some of the self-defense groups in Michoacán that appear, because you have civilians participating, with their own armies. And that has incorporated criminal groups, and also that has become a way that the government has been able to justify their presence without uniform. And supporting these militias in order to participate without having to pay the cost of violating human rights. That is another. This is a very important subject that needs very
complicated. It's a complicated. When you talk about militias, some have been co-opted by the drug cartels. Some are legitimate, and then others have become illegal operators in their own right. Is that what you're saying? It's not an easy subject to talk about in a general way. Is that right?
Exactly. That is right. Right. That is right. It's a very complicated subject that you cannot have just good and bad people. The self-defense groups are only good people that are protecting their families. You're having armed groups and criminal groups and the state take advantage of the existence of these groups that are trying to protect themselves in order to disguise themselves. And in the case of criminals, to continue providing, you know, this alleged protection and continue extracting rents. And on the other hand, you have the state that is continuing, you know, fighting this war against organized crime and utilizing these other armies to supporting them to fight against the criminal groups and evade their responsibility or continue violating human rights without having to really being accountable, because they are fighting in this war, they are disappearing people without uniform, and that gives them that possibility.
Right. Well, now, for these people to begin to expand, they've got to wash that money. They've got to laundry that money. In the past, Wachovia was caught, and it's proven that they laundered over $300 billion for those cartels, and they made about 10% of it. And then also HSBC was caught doing the same thing in Mexico, and they had to pay big fines. Are they still? Do they still have someone else, I guess, to launder the money?
Well, yes. That's a very interesting question. This is the money laundering part. How these criminal groups launder the money? They do it mostly in the formal financial sector. They do. They can. There are many ways that they can do it. They can do it also participating in other formal businesses, like any other formal transnational company. And we saw, for example, and this is what one of my colleagues and great friends, Melissa Del Bosque, wrote about this operation in with the horse racing, how this money is also, you know, put into the formal market through these activities, and how sometimes they buy properties and all that, but mainly the money is laundered in the financial sector, in these big banks, in the banks that they have supposedly good ways of looking at this, but they don't. because it's also convenient for several financial companies. And also they do it through these exchange rate places at the border or in other parts. There are several ways of laundering money, and not only at the border or in Mexico or in the United States. But it's a transnational financial system that helps to move and to move this money. And now with these new scandals that we have of how different people, different businessmen, different people in different parts of the world, you know, not launder, but evade taxes in fiscal paradises. So this money is moved everywhere, and utilizing formal and informal financial channels.
Right. So they're using business fronts, I guess, is what you could say, to filter some of this illegal money into, and then to bank it and to make it legal, you know, washed, I guess. There was one interesting thing that in my research over the past, the BBVA bank actually gave Hugo Chavez $1.5 million in 1998 and 99 when he first started running for office down in Venezuela. So the way I see it is that money is, they don't care about the politics, they want control, see? And so they'll go in and finance people either side of the political coin, you know, just to gain control.
Exactly. Just to gain control over, I mean, not to control, it's just to get more revenue.
Right.
Exactly. That finally translates into more, I mean, into more money, into revenue. So yeah, they move the money and they turn a blind eye of how it comes, but it's about money, it's about revenues for the banks and you know, more money that's moved by them, and they can utilize to provide more, to lend money and to get higher interest rates and all that. So most of the money is laundered because of the amount of money in the formal financial sector. More than just, you know, it's not the time when these drug trafficking organizations or just drug lords were buying ranches or horses only, but it is much more complex operations that the banks are not, I don't know if capable or not willing to supervise enough in order to get rid of that. And with the case of HSBC or Wachovia, we know that they have laundered money for important criminal groups, and that has caused, you know, human tragedies and the violation of rights and the murder of civilians, and they have directly, as indirectly, and I would say more directly, participating in the criminal activities by laundering money.
This civil war you're talking about then is between the cartels and the government then? Is that what you see? Is it getting worse and worse as time goes by?
No, it is transforming itself. It is already very violent, but it has been transforming itself. I am talking about a civil war that was declared by the Mexican state, but was declared by Felipe Calderón, and the formation of groups with links to state authorities, with links to government authorities. And these loss of the monopoly of violence by the state and the occupation of spaces by these criminal groups, or because of sometimes when there is a space left, a vacuum that's occupied by these criminal groups that provide protection, that take, like with these extortion fees, they charge money, taxes, to some extent taxation, providing protection, and try to get, you know, try to occupy the functions of the state with a confrontation with the state per se, and the direct confrontation with the state that declared war in the first place. So this is why I allege that this is a civil war, not just because of the number of casualties or the violence, the extreme violence of the groups and the murder rate and the control of territory, the practices, the utilization of high caliber weapons, and we're talking about real armies, criminal armies. The training of these groups has been, you know, formal. We're talking about people trained, people that have decided to leave the military and get access in some way to high caliber arms that they buy in different places, but mainly probably from places that are closer because that is much more profitable. We're talking about two armies. We are talking about the federal forces, the Mexican federal forces, the Mexican government, the Mexican military versus another army, and other criminal armies that participate as armies, but not necessarily with an ideology or a particular political
motivation. So you're saying the Vatos have evolved into a more and more formal military, governmental, paramilitary governmental army that's in opposition to the existing government and its army. Is that what you're saying?
I am saying today the Zetas have, and as I said before, this has been transformed. It's not getting worse and worse and worse. It's not being solved. The Zetas have declined as a regional corporation. They have now, they occupy now different spaces. They are more silent. They have already established their brand. The Zeta model has been expanded to other places and and the Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generación, have also diversified its criminal activities and also extract rents, Los Rojos, Los Guerreros Unidos, the Knights Templar at some point in time, and different groups have, you know, abused this model and this logic, this entrepreneurial logic. What I'm saying here is that they at some point dominated an important part of Mexico with a specialization in their tactics, the logic that caused fear, and their capacity of extracting rents by the control of territory was visible, was fundamental, and they expanded a new logic of criminality. The Zetas now don't exist. I mean, they are not the same group that we perceived in the years 2009, 2010, 2011, with the same capacity of fire at that point, because of course the participation of the government has fragmented the group and has created criminal cells that are not responding to a hierarchical, I mean, they were never a hierarchical organization of that in a traditional way. They always operated in cells, but they had more logic and they had the same brand and operated in a regional form. Now we're talking about different cells that are not very, very clearly located. So we are not saying that this has become more and more and more of a problem. It has been transformed, but the logic of operation and the model that they started continues with different names and the different the different brands in different regions. But the model that was advanced by the Zetas, you know, remains.
I see. There was an article recently of competition that the Zetas had in Ciudad Acuña. And it was some very small group, cartel, and I've forgotten the name of it. But you're saying that there's smaller groups that are springing up in different smaller areas? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
And they're following the model that the Zetas set out, okay?
Exactly. And the Zetas per se, I mean, the Zetas themselves, they have there are different cells of Zetas that now are called Zetas Nueva Escuela or the Northeast Cartel, Cartel del Noreste, that at some point belonged to this big regional organization that dominated half of the country, the Gulf Coast and northeastern part of Mexico, but now they operate in specific parts like the city of Ciudad Victoria, Tamaulipas, the capital city of Tamaulipas, Piedras Negras in Coahuila, or Nuevo Laredo, Tamaulipas, and different spaces or dominating particular activities.
Okay. Now, as far as any kind of solution to, say, the drug, cartel problem, where do you see it evolving from here? And is there any way to really clean this thing up or progress it towards a less of a criminal area. What do you think? What's going to happen from here on in the next 10, 15 years? What's your best ball?
If we don't solve the problem of corruption, we're never going to solve the problem of violence in Mexico and criminality. If this has happened, has been because somebody has been helping these groups, and the governors, the different authorities at different levels have been able or have been willing to participate in their activities or have been able to allow these activities to happen. And we know about that because there are several governors that have been linked to the Zetas in the recent past. I'm talking about two governors of Tamaulipas, a former governor of Coahuila, and for some also the current governor, the last two governors of the state of Veracruz, and at different levels of law enforcement agents, state authorities and local authorities, and also even federal authorities and some parts of the Mexican army, and, or some people that have belonged to this agency. So if we don't solve the problem of corruption, we don't give them an exemplar. Show of law enforcement on how really the rule of law needs to be strengthened and how we cannot just continue allowing this to happen, and nobody's going to be in prison for that, nobody's going to be in jail, nobody's going to be accountable if they participate with these groups. The situation in Mexico, the situation in Mexico will never change.
You think it'll just continue like this?
Unless there's the political will to change it, we're not going to transform our country. We all have an election in 2018,
okay.
And there is the possibility that we change the current structures. The PRI and the PAN have been involved and have been governing Mexico during the most violent times of what I call the Mexico Civil War. We have a historical opportunity of selecting or electing. Mexicans have a historical opportunity of electing a different possibility. But let's say, if the new possibility, is a winner, and they continue with the same patterns of corruption, we'll never solve the problem, and we'll continue with this. So at this point, we don't see any group that has been able to maintain itself out of the corruption. Any political party so far, there is a possibility of change, and let's see how they make it. One thing is to vote for change, and the other thing is to really achieve change.
Right. Is there a drug problem that has developed in Mexico among the people? Are there more and more people on drugs within Mexico itself?
Well, this is a great question. As you know, marijuana now...
Right, that's prevalent everywhere.
It's in the United States, yes. There's more supply. And of course, supply sometimes drives demand. There's not the drug problem as we see in the United States, this opioid epidemic that has to do also with the access of important amount of resources. We're talking about, for example, in Central America, Mexico, mainly, the consumption of cocaine or heroin, yes, it's probably, people have more access to drugs. Different type of drugs. But not yet. We haven't. I don't think we have gotten to the situation that the United States has gotten. It's more, we provide the passage of drugs from Colombia. Some drugs are produced in Mexico as well. We have this important border in a country that can pay for the drugs that is the United States. So yes, more drugs are consumed. Yes, there's more access. Drugs have lowered their price. Some of the drugs. But we cannot. I cannot consider as of today, that there is an epidemic that requires massive attention as it is in the United States. We don't have the amount of money to buy such amounts of drugs, but marijuana is extending, definitely.
Right.
I mean, the problem is extending.
Yeah, the reason why those drug cartels have made billions is that because we have all these American drug users over here. You know what I mean?
And so, exactly.
And so the Americans are driving this whole thing by their drug use, see?
That is correct.
So we've got to point the finger at ourselves here. You know, I mean, we've got these social problems that that generate a lot, increasingly amount. But then we have all of this legal, you know, painkillers now that is just these opiates and stuff. You know what I mean? Opiates and stuff. So, you know, it's just mounting. You know, it's just not unrealistic, but it's insurmountable problems that the American public and society has. Will that change, you think?
I believe that no, I think that yes, it can change, but if also Mexico does not solve its problem of corruption and the United States, it's never probably going to allow all the drugs to be consumed, and so these groups are always moving very fast as companies. It will help to solve the situation in other forms. The legalization of drugs would help, but we have seen that mafias and these groups always find a way to continue if there is corruption, and corruption exists on both sides of the border, and criminal activities are allowed. So if we don't really apply the rule of law, and the rule of law, I'm saying the rule of law not the rule of law only. I'm talking about the rule of law in Mexico and in the United States. I'm talking about treating this problem as a matter of public health.
Okay.
More than enforcing, you know, or prohibit the consumption of drugs, that we have seen that all this money that has been spent in the DEA and DEA operations have not been, you know, in any form useful or efficient. So I would say that we have to change, and the United States has to change its approach to solve the problem of drug trafficking and drug consumption, because it's not about the demand, it's not about the supply. It's about the demand.
If
they continue spending money in the DEA and the operations against these drug cartels, we're just going to see more violence spreading out, and the population in the United States continue dying of drug addiction. So definitely the approach is incorrect, and the United States would really like to spend the money in a different way, because they have been spending so much money in these law enforcement agencies that have not really assured, you know, a better condition in the country.
Well, there's corruption within our own agencies that have stopped drug investigations in Mexico.
So,
here we have corruption here, we have corruption down there. There's so much money. Should we just decriminalize the drug users here and just put them into, like you're saying, treatment and stuff, and look at it as a health problem, right?
Exactly. That would be a much wiser way to spend resources that have not really been used wisely. I would definitely not continue with this enforcement, with this law enforcement approach to drug distribution and drug supply. So I would focus on the demand side and solving this problem as a matter of public health in the United States. More probably would be better spent than in agencies like the Illegal Drug Enforcement Agency.
Right. Well, I have friends that interviewed in the past that were DEA agents, and they sort of, you know, in their interviews with me, we pretty well established the fact that we've got corrupt officials here in the DEA and Border Patrol and down in Mexico. Mordido is the word, right?
Right. And if there is corruption there,
yeah,
there is corruption in the United States as well. Because you cannot say that you have cartels in Mexico and in Colombia and you don't have how you distribute drugs here. I mean, if you have a lot of people in prison and people are still consuming drugs, somebody else is making money.
They're letting them through, yeah. You know what I noticed about Mexican families coming into the Texas area? We've got a number of Mexican families coming in that are the cleanest cut, finest families I've ever met. So there's a lot of good things in Mexico that want to try to get away from that violence and try to reform Mexico and you know, push in a different direction. But I don't know if it's going to happen, you know.
Exactly. That is right. That is correct. So we have to look for different ways of addressing the problems instead of spending resources in making, you know, more money for law enforcement companies, for arms producing companies. You create more violence by continuing militarizing drug and anti-drug trafficking operations. You create more violence, and you give the opportunity to these arms producing companies to have more businesses in south of the United States border, and you still have more people that are dying for overdose of drugs in your country. So this is really just benefiting this corporation. So that's why the title of the book is Los Zetas Incorporated, because it seems the business as a transnational corporation, and also the ones who benefit from this are transnational companies in different sectors, right, in the energy sector and in the border military industrial complex that includes some producing companies and private security companies.
You've been so comprehensive in the writing of this book, and you've covered so many different, very interesting subjects. And we've got about 3 minutes left in the program. Is there some concluding remarks or some announcements there about your website or anything else, up and coming book fairs that you'd like to make right now?
I'm trying to figure that out now. It's the end of the semester for me, but I'm sure we'll have more opportunity to advertise that. Of course, you can look at the website of the University of Texas Press to look at the information of the book, and I invite you to read it. And thank you for having me on the program. It's a pleasure, and you will receive your copy, of course. It will be an honor for me. That you would have my book.
I
invite
that.
Everybody else.
And
okay.
Yeah, we have up on our site already the press, the University of Texas Press, and we have up our Amazon page also, where you know they can look at the table of contents, and then there's different comments on there and so forth. But I would just want to thank you for being with us. Your insight and your enthusiasm carries the day, and it really makes an interesting read. I've read some of it already, but it's really a nice put together, very comprehensive. And you know what it is, too? The empathy that you have for the Mexican people is overwhelming, Guadalupe.
Because I'm Mexican.
That's right. That's right. But I mean, you really care about the Mexican public and the people, the community that you originally came out of and was born in. And that's a very beautiful thing. And we just got to try on both sides of the border to come together in a peaceful way and try to work through some of these social problems that we have on both sides of the border. You know, they're common to everybody.
Oh, okay. Yes. Thank you for your comments. Thank you for having me here, and we'll be in touch. And thanks for the nice words. And I will continue doing this work to try to address other aspects of organized crime in Central America and Mexico. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and it has been a pleasure to be with all of you
and
with your audience. Thank you
very, very much, Guadalupe. And good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.